Hello and welcome to Conquest Corner. Today I have the privilege of speaking with Edward Roskill. Edward is a private investor and also the co-founding partner of Strata Partners.
Pleasure to meet you, Peter.
Hello, Edward. How are you today?
I'm very good.
Now, Edward, ordinarily I start all my interviews with just asking the individual what their background is, how they got started in shares and investing, etc.
Sure.
And what the first things that piqued your interest in that.
It's a very good question, Peter. I think, and this is really going back into the dim and distant past, I remember when I was about 15 or 16, I started getting interested in stocks and shares. And I think I remember sort of opening up the paper and seeing these huge pages with all the stock prices and the way the prices moved and things. And I then got interested, and I think one of my very first investments was actually in traded options rather than shares.
Okay, that's interesting.
That was probably because with a very small amount of money, you could make it do something quite amazing
or lose
it completely very quickly.
Yes.
So I started off and I did, I remember some of the early investments were in put and call options.
Right.
Not written positions, not naked positions, just buying or selling puts and calls. And it was, when I look back at it, it's amazing how amateurish one was. I was. You know, you'd look at the price in the paper, you'd ring up the broker.
Yeah.
And I think, presumably because I was under 18, so I probably rang up my dad. I said to my dad, would you buy me some Trafalgar House call options?
Right.
And then, as luck would have it, you know, the first couple of trades or something turned out very well, and you get very excited.
Yes, of course.
And then probably I then made some bad trades, and then that was the end of that.
Mm.
And I do remember when I remember for my 18th birthday, I was given, my dad gave me, £500 of shares in two companies. And that was probably my first introduction. And then I'm trying to remember, it was probably also at that stage, it was probably UK privatisations and public offers and things were happening.
Yeah.
And I was very interested in it. But I look back and it was so, you know, how little I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And how amateurish I was. And even now, I still find I have lots to learn.
I was trying to just see the leap there from straight into call options and put options. Why was that?
I think it was simply that with a small amount of money, you could have a geared return.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, with, £50 or £100, mm-hmm. it was more interesting and more exciting than...
Right.
Than just buying the underlying security.
Okay. Was there any interest in the family at all? Was anybody in stocks?
I think that, yes, my father was always interested in investing.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to talk about it from time to time.
Yeah. So at 18, or there or thereabouts, you're given £500 by your dad.
Yeah.
And you went and invested in two companies.
I think he was probably sensible and gave me the two shares with the £500
in the first thing. They were valued at.
Yeah, yeah. They were valued at.
Yeah.
Because... he probably thought, well, I'll give you £500 in this share and £500 in that share, and they're quite good companies, so that's a good starting point.
Yes, foundations.
Rather than just give me £500 and say, well, you go and choose.
Mm.
And then I think I didn't really do any investing then. I did some very small things, maybe when I was in my early 20s.
Right.
And then when I then had my first job and had a bit more money, then I could do a bit more.
Okay, so just step back a little bit. Did you go to uni? What did you study?
Yes, I went to university. I studied law.
Mm-hmm.
I then qualified as a solicitor with a very good law firm. And I did corporate and commercial law.
Mm-hmm.
And I did merger and acquisition work with a firm called Freshfields.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I went into banking and made a switch from the legal side to investment banking. And I worked on the corporate finance side.
Yeah.
And I did that for 5 or 6 years with Robert Fleming and then JP Morgan.
Yeah.
And then I left JP Morgan in 2002 and then set up my own advisory firm.
Right, okay.
Called Strata Partners. Exactly.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to ask you a few questions about your time at Fleming and JP Morgan and your learning from that period, please.
That's a good question. I was doing IPOs, public company takeovers, mergers and acquisitions, some very large transactions. I was involved in all sorts of aspects of sort of large deals. That gave me a very good sort of ground up view of how these transactions are put together.
Yes.
But it was also slightly one dimensional.
Okay.
In that it's one thing in terms of preparing a company for IPO in terms of all the documentation and all the things that are going together. It's something else in terms of, is it a good investment?
Yes, of course.
And that's a different analysis and different viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
And coming at investing from a corporate finance and a legal background means that I come at it from a very logical, sort of rational type of approach.
Yeah.
And actually, there are many different aspects to investing which determine whether businesses are successful or not.
Of course.
And corporate finance and legal analysis and that side of things is only one aspect of it.
Very much so. Yeah.
So probably the best example is you can be you can do very, very detailed financial analysis and come up with your view of what the valuation of a business is. But that is a theoretical exercise based on lots of parameters. It'll have a range of correctness.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the stock market is probably the best way to describe it is, you know, the stock price is always going to be wrong. Mm-hmm. It'll never be right.
Yeah.
It'll only be right at 2 points only really in 1 point in time, which is when a business is sold and you have a strategic buyer coming to buy the business. At that point, the valuation, when I say correct, that is a very, very well-tuned, well-thought-through, or it should be, valuation exercise.
Unless it's a fire sale. Yeah.
That's very different. That's very different. And that's you know, that goes into the overall dynamics of what makes for a price.
Good valuation, yeah.
So you can be very theoretical about valuation, but that sort of takes away from it. At the end of the day, stocks and shares are based on supply and demand. And if there are a lot of people who want to buy something and there isn't the supply, the price will go up. It sounds terribly simple, but we sort of forget it. Mm. And equally, if a company is going to be issuing lots of paper,
yes,
you know, it's that in reverse.
Yeah.
So at JP Morgan and Fleming's, it was background around those larger transactions, public deals, private deals, from the point of view from a corporate finance perspective.
Looking from a different angle.
From a different angle. Yeah. And then I set up my own advisory firm,
Strata Partners,
advising technology businesses on M&A. And I did that from 2002 through till I'm still a partner there, so I still spend time there, but I spend less time now on that.
Okay.
And I probably spend about a third to a half of my time on the investing side and the balance on the advisory side.
So at Strata then, can you tell our audience some of the noteworthy companies that you've dealt with helped?
When I set the business up, one of the first transactions we did was to advise SunGard Data Systems, which was a new client for me, a US-listed company, large listed company, tech-based business, to advise them on an acquisition of a business called Guardian IT, which was a disaster recovery business, continuity business, that they bought for, I think it was $240 million. That was one of our sort of first deals. And then we've gone on
it's
and advised also. It's a good start. You think, you know, the problem with having good starts is then you realize that it's a lot harder than it might at first appear.
Yeah.
And then we've gone on and built the business up. And so it's a boutique firm. So we have about 15 people.
Mm.
And it's very much focused around technology businesses.
Okay.
Advising them on acquisitions, disposals, capital raising, those type of things.
I'm always interested to find out what sort of ethos the company has. Is it modeled on Edward Roskill's ethos regarding how things should be run and ethical issues.
It's interesting. I found that in the advisory world, particularly in larger organisations where people may have pressure to meet targets for revenue and things, mm-hmm. that's always likely to mean that people's advice may be skewed and slanted and not completely objective and in the client's best interests.
Yes.
So having one's own firm and not having any targets set by anybody else, you can be very, very straight mm-hmm. with the client and therefore have a very high degree of integrity and trust with the client.
Yes.
So that if you're advising them about something and you don't think it's a good idea, mm-hmm. I can tell them that. And I can't sort of say about client names, but, you know, a very successful £150 million market cap company, AIM listed. We were asked to help them with M&A work. And the very first piece of work they asked us to review, I basically said to the board, you could buy this business, but the margin of safety in terms of execution risk versus the price you're paying and the distraction to your core business, it isn't worth it. Don't do it.
That's good advice, yeah.
And saying to people not to buy something, very few advisors ever say that.
Mm. Because the loss of income as well.
Well, they just, yeah. You know.
They take the income anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then as a result of that, I then have, you know, then you then have a really solid relationship with them going forward.
Of course, yeah.
Because they know that you will be absolutely straight down the line and give them honest, objective advice.
Yeah, it's that building of trust, isn't it? That's
yeah,
what you need.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid in financial services and life generally, mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who don't have high integrity.
So 14 years on now from Strata, and how are you at the minute and how's the business going on?
So I spend, as I say, I'm still a partner at yeah. Strata, and I spend about a third of my time working on specific clients mm-hmm. and specific transactions, and I spend two thirds of my time yeah. managing own family investments.
Yeah.
And I focus on small cap, mm-hmm. and micro cap,
yeah.
AIM listed investments. Mm-hmm. I have made investments over the years in private businesses as well, but I now decide that I like to focus on the public markets,
yeah.
largely because asset managers, their business model is all about getting bigger, and they're asset gatherers.
Yes.
And the more assets they have under management, the more fees they make, and that is their business model. Mm-hmm. And that means that they have to climb up the size spectrum mm-hmm. of companies they can look at and can invest in. So yeah. to give you an example, if you were running a £100 million asset management fund, and assuming you didn't want to have too many individual stocks,
yeah.
your minimum position sizes might need to be between, let's say, £2 and £5 million.
Okay.
Right? That would mean that in the public arena, companies which you weren't able easily to buy a £2 or £5 million block of shares in, you couldn't really look at.
Of course, yeah.
And the effect of that is that the smaller part of the market, let's just say market capitalizations below £50 million,
okay.
is very, I would say, less well examined by, mm-hmm. by fund managers,
yeah.
less well looked at. And one can find little gems, but you've got to look really hard.
You've got to look really hard. Lots of research.
And, yeah, lots of research, lots of meeting of management, lots of visiting companies, lots of skepticism, lots of objectivity. And then from time to time, you find something which is a really brilliant business. And then you say to yourself, well, okay, I found that business, and it's a really brilliant business, and it's really sensibly valued. And then you sort of say, well, what do I not understand about it?
So that's ensuring that you've done your own sort of SWOT analysis on the company and making sure you've looked at the weaknesses, not just purely its strengths.
It's partly that. It's partly looking at the negatives and the positives.
Yeah.
But it's also saying, trying to use the cumulative wisdom of all the other investors
yeah.
and say they are valuing it in the market with a stock price.
Yeah.
Why are they valuing it at such a low level?
Mm-hmm.
And going back and looking at the history, the performance, the management team, what has been promised, maybe not delivered.
Yes.
What mm-hmm. expectations did investors have in the early mm-hmm. days? Maybe their expectations were set too high and it's taken mm-hmm. much longer to yes. achieve what yeah. it's achieved.
Mm-hmm.
At one level, people can be too gung-ho, and it's very easy. You press a couple of buttons. Oh, I bought the stock. Trying to be really thoughtful
mm.
and disciplined is really, really important.
Mm. No, I would agree with that. I think about 90% to master your own psychology, to understand why you're doing certain things, why you're investing in certain things, why you're not selling, or why you're continuing to buy a certain stock.
It's really interesting. And a lot of investing, as I would say, sort of, you need to know yourself
yep.
really well.
Mm,
mm. And there will be particular types of investment which will suit individuals, and some and not others.
Mm.
So I know for myself, unless I really, really understand the company, I could be liable to make a wrong investment decision
yeah.
if the price changes. So I sometimes say to myself, if I buy this stock today and I wake up tomorrow morning and the price is 50% lower,
mm-hmm.
provided I then go and test and say, why is it 50% lower?
Yes.
And there's no other external reason I can come to,
mm-hmm.
am I going to be okay with it? Am I going to go, oh, well, that's just an abnormal price movement? Would I sit there and say, I will buy more?
Mm-hmm.
And unless I can answer that and go, yes, if everything else is the same and the price is 50% below, I will buy more
mm-hmm.
because I'm so sure that I understand the business model
yes.
and the strengths and weaknesses of the business, that a large decline in price mm-hmm. won't cause me to have a change of conviction.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, yeah.
And it's quite a good test, that, because if you go, I'll give you an example. Oh, well, I did 10 minutes research and I thought that looks a good buy and I have some of that. And then tomorrow it's down 50%. I'm very likely to go, oh, well, I didn't understand it. I'll sell it.
Yeah. And that happens often.
And that, you know, that would mean that you hadn't done your thinking correctly in
yes.
the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And you've opened yourself up to making a bad investment decision, because you haven't actually made the correct analysis going into an investment. Trying to distinguish between the fundamentals in the business
yeah.
as one thing, and the stock price, which can be something completely
different. Yes, absolutely.
And therefore, when the price of something behaves really peculiarly, and it will,
yeah.
and most likely it's either gone up far too much or down far too much, when you can then look back at the fundamentals and sort of say, well, actually, this business, it's not going to go bust. It's got a very solid balance sheet. The customers are still buying.
Yeah.
XYZ is still happening.
Mm-hmm.
Then you sort of go, well, the price is a bit of an irrelevance, because unless I sell at this moment in time, the price isn't relevant to me.
Yeah.
The only time a price is relevant is when you either buy or you sell. Everything else in between, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And we all fall into the trap of looking at the prices too closely.
Or too often.
Too often,
yeah.
too closely, reading too much into it.
Mm-hmm.
And often it's just unhelpful.
Mm.
I seem to remember there was one fund manager, he used to have the Bloomberg machine, was down the other end of the office, quite deliberately, so that the fund manager, if he wanted to check the price on something, he had to walk down the office, take 5 minutes to log into the machine, and then see what the price was.
Thinking time, yeah. Mm.
And the reason for that was actually he should be making investment decisions based on the fundamentals and his analysis, not on what the stock price was.
Yeah. Mm. Or the analyst that's come on the show to say this is good or this is bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're predominantly in the small cap AIM sort of arena. I wanted to just touch on, for your own assessment, what you viewed yourself as in the sense of conservative, low risk sort of investor.
Yeah.
Because some people will say AIM, that means you're a high risk investor, but if you do your research, you don't have to be.
It's a very interesting point, Peter. You know, perhaps a really good example is you could go and buy a share in a FTSE 100 company at a bank and think, there we go. That's a nice, big, secure thing. Everybody's heard of RBX or whatever.
I
have no investments in banks. I've worked in banks. And the reason for that is I do not understand them properly. Right? And I don't think I have any edge whatsoever over any other investor investing in banks. Mm. Just because you're in something which is extremely large, you'll have liquidity so you can trade out of it, but you may have a false sense of security in terms of the quality of the business. The dividend yield may make you feel safe, comfortable. But actually, how much do you really understand about that business? By contrast, if I have investments, very, very few investments in large cap. And the reason for that is I want to focus on areas of the market where other people don't look. With the very large caps, you may think you're safe, but you really probably don't understand them properly or well enough. It will give you liquidity. You can trade out of them. You don't have the same issues in a small company. The liquidity may be there at 1 minute and gone the next. But it amazes me how even on quite large businesses, I'll talk market caps in the hundreds of millions.
Yes.
The liquidity can be very, very slim. So to give you an example, Hunting Group, which is quite a large cap company,
Oil services.
Oil services, exactly. Yeah. Oil services. The price and the volatility in that stock, it's been down this year to £2.40 with analysts saying sell. Right? Through to £5.20.
And they're now saying buy.
And what's interesting about that is that that's a large cap stock. And if you look at the price movements, even in fairly short time orders, you've got price movements of 10, 20, 30% over the space of a month, 6 weeks.
Yes.
Huge movements. And I look at that company and I go, I don't have a better, more accurate view of the forecast than the analysts. So I'll take the analysts' forecasts as to what they think it'll do by way of profits and performance. And they had to reset their banking covenants. And they had to promise not to pay any dividend. And if you look at the market forecasts, you have to look out at least 2 years for the oil price, the market to have recovered, for the current valuation to look, in my mind, to look vaguely sensible.
Yes.
Even in larger businesses, you can find the share price volatility is quite extreme. And there are fairly small movements on a day, low millions of pounds traded in the context of a Hunting Group, can move the thing 10, 15%. So volatility in the market is definitely increased.
Yeah.
Not just in an oil services sector, but just across the market as a whole.
Does this go back to, we've spoken with a few people about this, about the use of tech and the fact that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there's people choosing a stock, ringing the broker, sending off a little form, waiting a week. And now it's like you're on your iPhone, you're on a particular phone, bang, 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 you're selling, you're buying, you're selling, you're buying. And that
there's certainly a lot high more frequency, a lot more high frequency trading. There's a lot more technology. And volumes have definitely gone up and trading. If you remember in the old days, you used to, a standard commission rate used to be 1%. Well, I mean, anybody paying 1% for an equity trading
now
on mainstream stocks would be out of their mind. So technology has enabled it to be done much more efficiently at much lower cost. And the structure of the market's changed a lot. But that does mean that the volatility's increased.
And there's an appearance now that people want to get rich quicker. You know, the speed, everything's about speed. They don't want to hold that stock for a dividend and watch it for 3, 4, 5 years. It's like, you know, a rush to make money.
This is a really interesting point, actually. And I tried to, I was thinking about, for my children who are 13 and 15, and I was thinking, how do I get them interested in stocks? And what is the really important lesson I can teach them? And I came to the conclusion, it was a really simple one, which was, let's try and teach them the importance of compounding and the importance of consistency. And if I did two examples for the children, I couldn't get them to concentrate on it, so I'll give it to you as an example.
Okay, I'll focus.
But one of them, there was stock A, which performs over a five-year period, and it goes sort of 7%, 5%, this is up, plus 5%, plus 7%, plus 6%, minus 2%, plus 6%. What's the compound return over the period? I won't ask you.
Right, okay.
And you have another stock which goes plus 25%, plus 15%, minus 30%, minus 12%, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And if you just presented it and you didn't say to somebody, please calculate what the better stock is.
Yeah.
Almost everybody would be drawn to the stock that goes plus 25%, plus 30%. And they've actually forgotten that when you then look at the minus 25 and the minus 12 and everything else, and I deliberately chose two examples where on the face of it, one looks so much better to an investor, but actually the low performing consistency at 7%, 6%, 5% produces a higher compound return with less volatility and less risk than the other one.
It's
incredibly important that we really, really focus on this thing, which is don't lose money. It's the sort of most important tenet of investing. Because if you start losing money, you've got to run twice as fast or more to catch up. Therefore, for me, in terms of style and when I look at investing, I really, really focus hard now on saying, if I buy this stock and I can never sell it again, is it going to be okay? And if you can't really answer that and go, well, not really sure, I probably shouldn't really be buying it.
So essentially, you're a low-risk investor then. You're looking for the best quality for consistent returns over the long term.
I'm looking for, number one, not losing money. Number two, I'm looking for, I would describe it as asymmetric risk-reward, which is basically like saying, the downside, if everything goes wrong with this company, maybe it goes down 20%, 25%, but the odds are stacked in its favor. So the chances are, fingers crossed, if things go well, it will go up 100%, 200%. So it's highly asymmetric in terms of the downside is much more limited compared with the upside.
Okay. Are you also taking into consideration that you potentially found an under-researched stock, which potentially later on when, as I call it, the herd arrives, they'll think,
That could well be the case.
As well.
So trying to find things which other people have misunderstood or looking at in the wrong way or haven't spent the time on or has had a checkered past in before and not done well, but perhaps now things are different and have changed. And trying to assess very carefully the quality of a business. That's really, really important.
No, I get that. What I was going to touch on as well is that given your background in banking and M&A and tech, do you have a preference to any particular sectors?
It's a really interesting question, Peter. And the answer is no, I look across the entire market. There are a few sectors I don't like, largely because I think they require specialist knowledge, which I do not have. And investors can underestimate the risks. So the ones that spring to mind will be oil and gas exploration, natural resources, and biotech. And generally, I don't make any investments in those areas. Generally, there's always exceptions. Particularly on the natural resources side, they are very susceptible to extreme valuation moves, often on the upside, moving to valuations which are very out of kilter with the underlying fundamentals of the business, largely because, if we're really simplistic about it, if you've got a mining company and it's in a development phase, you can't really judge it from looking at the financial return profile in terms of the balance sheet and the income statement and the cash flow, because it hasn't yet got a mine in production.
Yeah, of course.
That means, in simple terms, that it's much more susceptible to over-promotion, mm-hmm. or, put it another way, management teams selling a story. Mm-hmm. Which is out of reality with the facts.
Yeah.
And only somebody who is very, very knowledgeable about that particular sector would realise that the message they were portraying was perhaps unrealistic or was overambitious. And then the other thing about mining is that it's very capital intensive.
Of course, yeah.
It's got lots of execution risk, which, as the investor, you always underestimate. And therefore, when things go wrong, not if things go wrong, when they go wrong, you can be sure that they will need more money.
More money, yeah. Cap in hand.
And that will usually involve, if they've got debt, then it can be in all sorts of difficulties. Or if it doesn't have debt, it will need more equity. Mm. And you look at a very recent example, Diamond Corp, which is... Yeah, it's got Tiffany in there. I think it was Tiffany, or a major offtake agreement.
Yeah.
Well funded. They had some bad luck. They never had quite enough capital as a buffer. And long story short, you know, it's just gone bust. You know.
Yeah.
And that can happen very rapidly. What I tend to do is look instead at particular types of business model that I really like. And the business models I tend to look for are those which are highly defensive, ideally what I call recurring revenue models. So where you have a locked-in customer who continues to buy from you, whatever the weather, whatever the economic environment, because you're providing, you either have the contractual protection they're locked in, and or you're providing something which they really need. Then what happens is that, providing you're not losing customers, which is another important aspect, every time you win a customer, you're adding it on top of your existing customer base.
Yes.
And if your business is one with high gross margins and strong operational gearing, there can be a very powerful drop through.
Yeah,
every additional pound of revenue may generate significantly higher than you would expect percentage coming through to the bottom line in terms of profits.
Okay.
So if I give you an example, and this is quite a good example actually, a recent investment where it's a medical med tech company, medical device company. It's not biotech.
Right.
It's a medical device company called Lidco.
Yeah.
And I looked at this, and it'd been on the market for a very long time.
Yes, it has been. Yeah.
And you talk to different people, and essentially there had been, I would say, it had never quite fulfilled its potential or what people had hoped for.
Been on the cusp for a good while, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And when you peel back the layers of the onion and you look at the business, you say, is there anything good here? Something jumped out at me, which was, their own product revenues, about £6 million. And of the £6 million, £5 million is recurring revenues. This is a good example where I wouldn't have minded whether this was in a medical device company or a software business or some other area. It has a very interesting recurring revenue stream. And then the other aspect to it is that it has a gross margin of 80% plus.
Very good margins, right?
Now, again, this is something I don't think people sort of spend enough time thinking about.
Yeah.
If you have a business with very high gross margins, usually that's because they have some IP protection or something which is differentiating them from others. Yeah. But effectively, it means that you can operate in quite a small market, or put it another way, even if you only achieved £10 million of revenue, you would have £8 million of gross profit. And depending on what your fixed cost base is and how fixed it is, you may have a very high drop-through rate. Another very, very high-quality business, again, IP-based type business, called Bioventix, which is an antibody company in very simple terms. And what's interesting about that, again, is it's a royalty stream business model.
It's a big favorite, again, big favorite of Leon Boros.
Exactly. Leon knows it very well.
Yeah.
And that, again, I can't even remember the revenue. It's very small. If I say it's probably sub £10 million revenue, but very, very high gross margin. It's only got 11 people or 12 people in the business. And the market capitalization, I think it's about 40 or 50 million. Right? So
low costs, yeah.
You know, very low, low cost, smart people, a lot of IP, very high gross margins, strong recurring revenues.
And you're taking into consideration, obviously, what the market cap is in comparison to the revenue stream and the profits. So it can't be valued at 200 million if it's just got revenue of six. So
people need to do their research properly.
Filters,
you know, they need to look at the size of the company, what are its fundamental financial performance metrics. There are lots of companies out there where I just laugh at the valuation. I go, why on earth is it capped at 50 million or 100 million when the business is living on grant funding, or it's got revenues of less than a million, and it's all based on hope value, or it's based on, you know, a nice investment growth story which may or may not come through.
Now, Edward, I wanted to ask you what has been your greatest lesson thus far from going from, you know, 18 years of age, dad giving you two stocks, working at very significant companies, to now as a private investor. What would you like, lessons you'd like to share with us?
I think the most important thing is to keep being self-critical and to keep questioning your own judgment. Even when you've had some good success, to keep your feet really firmly on the ground and not allow yourself to be hubris to take over and say, oh, well, that was clever. Didn't I do well on X, Y, Z? Well, did I do well or was I lucky? What? Why did I do well?
Yeah.
And to keep doubting one's own investments one's made and critiquing them, because that's what keeps you safe. I found the way I track my investments, I don't track, obviously, the entry prices. So I don't have a portfolio which says, stock A, I paid, you know, I'm winning or losing, making or losing money on that stock. All I know is how many shares I hold of it.
Right, okay.
Now, I can track and I can look back and find out exactly what I paid for it, but I don't actually track it because it's actually not relevant.
Yeah.
What's relevant is either I think it's a good investment and I should still own it and I hold it.
Yes.
And I'm prepared to buy more, or I shouldn't own it. The fact that I paid something, a price for it, and what that price was, is not that relevant. And I historically have always had a bit of a, and we all do this, a bit of loss aversion. So you hate seeing, oh gosh, if I sell that, I'm going to crystallize the loss.
Of course.
And, oh, I don't think I want to do that. By not tracking, obviously, on your portfolio, the entry price, and just tracking the exposures, it makes it quite easy.
Okay. So do you, in the sense of, is that your diary then?
I'm quite rigorous about trying to make a lot of notes. So I see lots of management teams. I go on lots of visits. I can't keep everything in my head. I need to write it down. And then sometimes I find it very helpful after a meeting to actually write it, when I have time, to write up the notes again, to think about the meeting again, to think about what my impressions were, and think about the facts. Rather than perhaps having a knee-jerk reaction to a meeting, oh, I'll buy it or I'll sell it.
Yes.
To digest it, to take it away, to sleep on it, to think about it, to reread your notes. Particularly if you do meetings with people over a long period of time.
Yeah.
So if I'm studying a company and it's a small company, I will maybe visit them, see them regularly over a period of months. I haven't even bought the stock at this point, perhaps.
Just doing your research.
But I'm then forming a view of what do I think of the management team? They told me this 6 months ago or a year ago. What's happened? What's come to pass?
Yes.
What's the journey and the direction of travel? What's going on? So in a way, that's the sort of, if you like, the diary or the investment assimilation of thinking. on some of these smaller stocks, once you've bought them, you may never be able to sell them again if they don't go right. So you better make really sure that it's a good thing to be buying.
Indeed, yeah.
I had one stock the other day, and it's a classic example. I bought something, and I knew when I bought it, I wasn't, and I only took a very small position size, and I knew I didn't think much of the quality of the business. And I was doing it for it was more of a trade than an investment, okay?
Right, okay, big differences, yeah.
I had trouble selling £1,500 of stock.
Right?
And I knew if I didn't sell it, it would go down over a period of time, it would halve in value.
Mm.
But I couldn't sell it for love nor money. If I get uncomfortable with an investment, right, and I'm not happy with the investment, mm-hmm. I generally these days will try and reduce the position down and not just simply hope it gets a bit better.
Yeah.
And particularly if, I'll be very candid, if management have lied to me,
yeah.
And I've seen it where they've made regulatory announcements without a proper basis for making them, and then 3 or 4 months later you realise it was a load of crap.
Yeah.
And the question I now say to myself is, if somebody lies to me, even on something quite minor, what else are they not telling me about? And I don't want to be partnered up with people who I don't trust.
Absolutely.
You tell me the things as they are, straight down the line. And if you can't or you won't, I don't want to have anything to do with you.
Absolutely.
Another really interesting thing, somebody said to me the other day, and I meet so many people, and it was a great, we were talking about management remuneration. And he said to me, and it was a really, I'll see if I can quote it, it was basically saying, the second worst thing after fraud, his words, is management greed. Because effectively, management greed is legalized theft. And when you see senior management taking very large remuneration, and that may be large relative to the size of the company or relative to the performance or relative to other companies, whatever, you need to say to yourself, why do I want to be investing in that person who has that business approach? I don't mind being aligned with management. I don't mind aligning with management who are going to make a lot of money if the company does well. But I don't want to be aligned with people who are going to make money hand over fist for doing a poor job.
Regardless of performance,
Regardless of performance. Because that's not alignment. That's just being ripped off.
Yeah.
And people who, management who are excessively greedy on remuneration will often have culture and ethics and other things which permeate the business, which you don't want to be associated with.
Impact the growth, and other companies won't want to associate with them as well.
Impact the growth, I mean, they just may set the wrong tone. You know, if the CEO is being paid £500,000 and the business is losing money and he's still taking bonuses and this and the other, what message does it send to the other staff? And, you know, there are cases in point where sometimes we don't, as investors, remember that small businesses in particular, the success or failure of them is down to the senior management team and who those people are and what their history is and their track record and how they operate. You know, a leopard doesn't often change its spots. So if you look back and you see that somebody previously was a disastrous CEO and drove a company into the ground, and they turn up 5-10 years later at another business, you need to be really careful and mindful.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to give a specific example, which I don't normally do.
I know which one you're going to say. Go ahead.
So, and it just comes to mind, but John Hawkins, who was CEO at Anite, a long, long, long time ago, and did a large number of acquisitions using company shares as currency. And basically drove the company into the ground, paid himself a lot of money in the process. He pops up then, I don't know, 10 years later or whatever it is, at Vislink. And you look at the remuneration on that.
And what's happened with Vislink since.
And you look at that. Mm-hmm. It's a sorry story.
Yeah. I actually thought you were going to say Innovation Group and then Quindel. That's what I thought you were going
to
say.
You know, I spend a lot of time trying to learn to listen better, because the way that people phrase things and explain things can often give you insights as to, bluntly, how trustworthy they are. And I remember in the case of Quindel, Rob Terry, his presentation materials were incredibly detailed, with lots of graphs and numbers and figures and this, that, and the other. Now, on the one hand, you can read that as saying, very analytical, thoughtful, X, Y, Z. But then when you sort of dig below the surface and you talk to other people in the market, people go, well, I don't quite understand how this group is making its money and what it's doing. You realize that the presentation materials and what's being shown to you is designed to try and obfuscate from the real truth and look beguiling and try and impress you. And if you look, for example, and it was a really, back to my earlier comment about if you can't trust the chief executive or a course of conduct is not straight down the line, then what else are they not telling you? And there was some very good examples on the Quindel case where he'd done quite a complicated equity financing structure using derivative instruments to effectively raise money in a way which wasn't apparent to the market. And then he had to unscramble the whole thing and come clean on it. And without going into all the detail, what that should be saying to you is, if he thought that was an appropriate way to raise money, and by subterfuge, I'll be blunt about it, what else does he consider to be acceptable?
Indeed.
And if you can't, you know, and it's a bit like the old expression, no smoke without fire.
So I wanted to touch on your wisest investment decision to date, Edward.
I describe my favourite investments should be like shooting fish in a barrel, right?
Okay.
You should know the fish are there, and you basically shoot in the barrel and you know you're going to hit them, right?
Yeah.
That's what you want. And there was a point in time, this is going back quite a few years into sort of 2002, 2003. Do you remember about investment trusts and there were split capital trusts?
Yes. Yeah.
Which were, without getting into the detail, there were different rights to different classes of shares.
Yeah.
And they fell out of favor and everybody was running scared.
Yeah.
And there was one investment trust, 90% of the assets were invested in FTSE 100 or FTSE 350. I can't remember which it was. It was very good quality portfolio.
Yeah.
It had very little debt. And I did a calculation which basically said the discount at which you could buy it, you were basically buying into the FTSE 100 at a, I'll get the number slightly wrong, but if I say to you it was a 60% discount, right, to the underlying
value.
And I did another calculation which said, and this was going to wind up in, say, 3 years' time.
Right. Okay.
So you say to lose money on this investment, the FTSE would have to fall, I can't remember, I did the calculations, and 30% and stay there for another 3 years. That was something which, you know, you go, the margin of safety was so significant. Although you were buying only a single investment trust, it was diversified across all these other things. That was a bit of a no-brainer. And there were people selling it, goodness knows why. Yeah. And there are things like that from time to time. People throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
It's always safe to pick up £1 coins for the value of 40 pence, isn't it? 50 pence.
Absolutely.
Now, given where you started, yeah. there wasn't as much tech, and there's now much tech, if there's one thing you could change in the investing landscape that you couldn't do as an 18-year-old young man with your dad's supervised account, what would you change today, Edward?
It'd be wonderful if we had a register of dodgy management teams.
I think we do have that, just that it's not published.
Well, this is the problem. It's not published. And people
and
are so afraid
they keep coming back.
That, exactly. And people are afraid of being sued for being making libelous comments. Mm. That people don't put their hand up and say the things. Now, clearly, you can, as you get a bigger network of investors and you know many other people, you can diligence people.
Yes.
And check people out. Mm-hmm. And you will find out.
Yes.
There are warning signs. There are things you can watch out for. Mm. The classic is where you see very high market capitalizations, very low revenue and profitability numbers, very weak balance sheets, very big executive management remuneration, lots of awards of shares at low valuations as options or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. These are all massive red flags. They may just be literally out to promote the stock and rip your face off.
As we call them, lifestyle companies.
That's quite a polite way of putting it. But, you know, in amongst unscrupulous businesses on the markets, and it can be any market globally anywhere, there are some brilliant businesses, indeed, some very talented, honest management teams. And finding those ones and finding out who those ones are, that really pays dividends.
It does. It's about looking out for those gems. Now, Edward, I've covered all my questions that I wanted to ask you. I've got one more, though, because I'm a big book fan. I didn't know if there was any books or authors that you have found interesting.
That's a really good question.
That's a book that I would like to recommend for people to go out and
The answer is, there is one book which I read quite recently, which is really interesting. It's more of a psychology book than an investing book, which is called, I can't remember the exact title, it's called How to Spy a Lie.
Interesting,
It's written by some CIA interrogators, and it's all about how to listen carefully to what people are saying to try and pick up from how they say things whether they may be lying to you. And it's not going to tell you they're lying, but it says it may give you some indications that you need to dig a bit deeper.
Yeah. Okay, that's a noteworthy book. I'll have to have a look at that one myself.
It's quite fun.
Okay. Edward, I've finished, covered all my
Thank
questions.
You.
I don't
Thank
know if there's anything you want to encapsulate.
I think the most important thing of all, I think, is to try and share with other investors your thoughts, both positive and negative, because collective decision making is often more powerful than just doing something on one's own.
No, that's a very good closing point. Thank you very much, Edward.
Pleasure to meet you, Peter.
Thank you very much. Thank you, chap.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All the very best.